All right, we're good. We're rolling. Happy Chanukah, everyone. How are we all doing? Excellent. Thank you all for joining. If you guys want to come to the Chanukah class, please. So, as you can see, I have hours and hours worth of material that I just passed around. We have a good 15, 20 minutes to have an in-depth Chanukah shmooze. What I'd like to do with you is to study one halakha, the one law in the Rambam, the great Maimonides, on the laws of Chanukah, with, of course, the explanations and applications of the great Rabbi Soloveitchik. If anybody wants a great book on Chanukah, a couple of years ago, they just came out with the writings of Rabbi Soloveitchik on both Purim and Chanukah. It's a green cover. And if you go to a Jewish bookstore and you say you'd like Rabbi Soloveitchik on Purim and Chanukah, they'll give you this green book. I forgot what it's called. But this is a photocopy from the book, and it's essentially the Rabbi Soloveitchik's writings on Maimonides. And I want to get into, really dive right into some of the important themes of Chanukah. We talked about it last week. This is some new material. Follow with me, if you can, take it from the laws of Chanukah, from the Rambam. Everybody should have two things. One is a single sheet, and one is a packet. This packet is for you to take home. We're not going to get through the whole thing in the next 15, 20 minutes. Okay, but we're going to plow through some important parts. You guys with me?
Yeah.
Excellent. Happy Chanukah, guys. This is it. Take a look. The menorah. Is it wrong?
There should be another one.
There we go. It's not how you like it. We're going to do it in the other room. No, that does not suffice. That does not. You cannot actually satisfy the requirement of the menorah from electricity. That's for all the hotel lobbies and apartment buildings, you know, next to the tree. We're going to actually light the menorah in a few minutes, and we'll show you how it's done then. Okay, B'bayit Sheni, which is the second temple era. Follow with me. The Shemalcha Yavan, when the kingdom of Greece, Gazru Gzerot al Yisrael, issued decrees against the Jewish people, Ubitlu Datam, and they tried to obliterate our religion, and they did not allow us, as the Rambam, to engage in Torah and mitzvos. The first thing Rabbi Soloveitchik asks is he's speaking about in the Second Temple era. It says, when the Malchei Yavan, when the kingdom of Greece existed, they decreed these decrees on the Jewish people. And the Rambam asks the obvious question, is this historically accurate? Was the kingdom of Greece the government that was around when these decrees were actually being promulgated? Does anybody know? Any history buffs here? When you take a look on your handout on page 180 on the bottom, Rabbi Soloveitchik asks, it says when the Greeks ruled. Actually, though, the wicked kingdom was not Greece. What was the kingdom?
Syria.
It wasn't Rome. It was Syria, but take a look. This occurred in the post-Alexandrian period. Alexander the Great. The Hanukkah story did not happen during the time of Alexander the Great, and he was Greece. The enemy did not consist of genuine Greeks. They were another people who were assimilated to Greek culture and to the Greek language. The Hellenized Syrians invaded the land of Israel. After the death of Alexander the Great, his empire disintegrated into a number of provinces. So why do we ascribe these persecutions to the Greeks, who actually lived hundreds of miles away? So Rabbi Soloveitchik answers, very important and interesting notation on history. He says, because although the people, Antiochus, who was the head of the Greek Seleucid Empire, they weren't technically Greek, actually, but he writes that they found its source in Greece's intolerance and superiority complex. He says, essentially, the first time there was ever religious persecution for the Jewish people was the Chanukah story. There was never actually an episode where there was someone else who came before and said you could not continue to observe your religion. Now, what holiday actually happened before Chanukah? Purim. Isn't that a case in point? But what was the difference with Purim? Haman really was not out to try to obliterate Judaism. He was out to obliterate Jews. He didn't really care if the Jews actually converted to whatever religion the Persians were observing, Zoroastrianism or whatever the religion was called. He was really out. This is the first time that the Jewish people were being persecuted religiously. You know what I mean by religiously? Meaning we didn't have to be persecuted. All we had to do was what? Change. Antiochus would have been much happier had we simply become Hellenized than if we fought back. He didn't want to have a war on his hands. Now, what does that have to do with Greece? So Rabbi Soloveitchik writes that Greek culture was responsible for this. Look at the second paragraph on the right. Alexander the Great had a dream of conquering the world, but not for the sake of conquest and power. Alexander the Great was a missionary for Greek culture. And he goes on to say in the next paragraph where it's underlined that when people develop the idea of mission, to conquer the world in order to cultivate it, religious persecution is inevitable. Because then not everybody wants to go along with the game. And then he goes on to say that Judaism, one of the things that's very interesting about Judaism, is that we're not a missionary religion. We don't want to bring our religion to the entire world. We want to bring God and concepts of monotheism to the world. But we're not out to make everybody Jewish. We're actually even resistant or hesitant sometimes to accept a convert unless they are sincere and genuine in their interest. And the Greeks, he says, the reason it says that the Rambam says the Greek kingdom, even when it wasn't technically the Greeks, is because this philosophy that everybody's got to think like us, everybody's got to be like us, or no, or not, that came from Greece, that came from Alexander the Great, that came from hundreds of years earlier, even though this story took place later. Now take a look at the next line that we said in the Rambam. He says that they didn't permit us. The English is not good. It says to observe the Torah and its commandments. The Hebrew says la'asok. Does anybody know when that word is used in our prayers each morning? La'asok b'divrei Torah. To what?
Immerse.
To immerse ourselves in the words of Torah. That's the blessing that we say when we get up and we make the bracha of the Birchat Ha. We make blessings over in the morning over the blessings of the study of Torah. We don't say l'ilmod Torah, to study Torah. What do we say? La'asok b'divrei Torah, which means to immerse ourselves in the words of Torah. What's the difference between studying something and immersing yourself in it? What's the difference? Because the Rambam's language is very, very important. What would you say is the major difference? To study something as opposed to immersing yourself in something. Dabble? Well, let's say it's a serious learning. Let's say you're being tested on it even.
I would say one is just limited to the actual studying, while the rest is actually
changing your life because of it. Excellent. Take a look on page 185, where it says number 2. Where it says number 2, page 185. It says, while l'mod, you see where it's underlined on the right? The word l'mod has limited semantics, referring to the intellectual gesture exclusively. Okay? The verb la'asok means to be involved, to be dedicated. The involvement may express itself in a variety of ways. Take a look at the last paragraph. The Syrians tried to prevent the people from commitment rather than from study. They wanted to extinguish the flame of devotion and all-out dedication to Torah. They prohibited Torah education rather than Torah study. They did not care about elderly scholars isolated in their respective corners. They cared about dynamic scholars teaching Torah in public. Like some Jew, some Yid sitting there reading a Jewish book. They didn't care. What they cared about was teachers getting up and inspiring their students to not merely study, but to immerse themselves in the ways of Torah. That's what the Greeks were trying to extinguish. And therefore, what did they do? Let's go back. It says in the Rambam, it says, "Upashtu yadam b'mamonam u'bibnotehem." And they extended their hands. We're back in the one sheet, the single sheet again. I know I'm flipping back and forth. They extended their hands into our money, u'bibnotehem, and our daughters. Now, what does that mean? Into our daughters. Take a look on page 186, where it says number 3, back in the other packet. It says they laid their hands, it says not just on their property, but also on their daughters. This brings us to a basic principle in Judaism, which is referred to as tzniut. I'm sure many of you have heard of this term, which refers to sexual modesty and morality. No other moral norm is essential. This is Rabbi Soloveitchik speaking, and as important in Judaism as that of sexual modesty. And he goes on to say that Judaism holds the view that human dignity and majesty can be achieved only through protecting sexual morality. And if the latter is abolished, then man, no matter how agreeable and creative, forfeits the extra existential dimension that the Almighty granted him. Moral laxity and looseness makes man retreat from the human to the natural kingdom, replacing meaningful life with a mechanical pressure. And he goes on and on. You get the basic idea of how important modesty. And what were the Greeks trying to do? They were trying to attack those areas that they understood. Our Salvation later on, I'm not going to get to it, says if you want to know what is so special about a Jewish community at any time, you look at what your enemies are attacking. That's why Rabbi Zev Reichlin, who teaches one of our fellowship classes, once said that you want to know what's special about our generation. This is Rabbi Salvechik's idea, Rabbi Reichlin quoted. He says it's the state of Israel. Why? Because every anti-Semite in the world now will not necessarily call the Jews a terrible people, but will focus that enmity on the state of Israel. And at that point, says Rabbi Salvechik, here the focus is on what? Was on the modesty. And that's why, if you continue on, actually, anybody know there's a minhag to eat dairy? I don't know how many people follow this minhag. It's not very prevalent. It's a custom to eat dairy on Hanukkah. Anybody know why you're supposed to eat dairy on Hanukkah? Because of... Very good. You both got it. Jinx. Because of Judith. Who is Judith? Judith was from the Maccabean family. There was this terrible edict that the night before a Jewish bride would be married, she had to submit herself before a Greek official, usually someone in the military. And this was a terrible, terrible thing that became instituted during the time of Antiochus to once again really attack at a part of the Jewish community that they knew was so special and distinct. And Judith took the opportunity, I forget the exact details, Chana, you'll help me out, or whatever, Joey, it was a general, I'm told, it was a Greek general, fed the general
salty cheese,
right, causing him to get really thirsty, so he would drink lots of wine. That's what I remember studying. He drank lots of wine until he eventually fell asleep, and she decapitated him and placed his head sort of in effigy so that nobody would mess with the Jewish women anymore. And it was actually quite effective, according to tradition. This is one of the things, but you have to understand what was going on. This is one of the things that was happening during the Hanukkah story. So what the Rambam says, that they were extending their hands against our property and against our daughters. This was a very, very specific campaign against what was important in the Jewish community. Let's continue on. The Rambam continues to say, back on the one single sheet, v'nichnasu lahechal, and they entered our sanctuary, u'partzu bo pratzot v'tzimot ha'aros. Why did they bother coming into our temple? It's like the biggest anti-Semites in the world. They're going to come into our synagogue. They're going to desecrate our synagogue. Come on, what's the big deal? They understood. Rabbi Salvation writes this, you'll see it on your own. But they understood the central institution of Jewish life during the Maccabean revolt, during this period of time, was the temple, the Beit HaMikdash. And that's why, as we discussed last week, they tried corrupting the kahuna, the priesthood. And they tried putting in their own Hellenists, Jews, who had not formally converted, but essentially abandoned Judaism in favor of Hellenism, and try to get them into becoming the new high priests. And it was essentially the end of the kahuna, of the priesthood. Ashirichem aleihem avitzar lahem liyisram. All this is read in English. The Jews suffered great difficulties from them, for they oppressed them greatly until the God of our ancestors had mercy, delivered them from their hand, and saved them. The sons of the Chashmonaim, the high priests, overcame them, slew them, and saved the Jews from the hand. We talked about the battles last week. They appointed a king from the priests, and sovereignty returned to Israel for more than 200 years. Why is that important? The Salvechik asks, if you look at number 4, actually, which is back in your handout, why does the Rambam, it's on page 192, the Jewish sovereignty was returned to the Jewish people. What is the question? See if anybody can figure out the question from the Rambam. The Rambam just said that the Jewish people were saved, right? And we're able to be okay. Why does the Rambam have to say, and we had political sovereignty for the next 200 years? Who cares? The Rambam is writing on a religious sense. We purified the temple. we got rid of our Greek oppressors. So asks Rabbi Soloveitchik, why did Maimonides have to tell us that Jewish sovereignty was restored? Wasn't it enough that the temple was purified and that the sacrificial service was restored? There was no more physical or religious oppression. Jews could study the Torah, perform mitzvah. Jewish women were saved. Jewish property was protected. Isn't that enough? So he answers very important. The Gemara asks, why Hallel? You guys know we say the Hallel every day of Hanukkah. Hallel is praises of Hashem. Why Hallel is not said on Purim? You know that we don't say Hallel on Purim, but we do say it on Hanukkah. Anybody know the classic reason for this? Why do we say Hallel every day of the 8 days of Hanukkah? We don't say it on Purim. So one of the explanations is, it's because what we're talking about. Because in Purim, when there was a great miracle that saved the Jewish people from what? Extermination. One answer is that the recital of the Megillah is a substitute for Hallel, right? We don't have a Megillah. There's actually no part of the Torah that records the Hanukkah story. Most of our information is from secular sources. But Purim has a what? Purim has a text. It has a part of the Bible, canonized, called Megillat Esther. So that's why we don't need Hallel. And Soloveitchik actually believed that the reading of Megillat Esther publicly was Hallel, basically. Another answer is that one does not recite Hallel. This is the answer I want to get to. If the miracle takes place outside of Israel. Why? If there's a great miracle happens to the Jewish people, who cares what happened? But it didn't happen outside of Israel. Now we don't say Hallel, we're not as thankful. Third answer he gives. The third answer is that the verse, Hallelujah Avdei Hashem, praise, O servants of God. That's the verse from where we learn to say Hallel. Therefore, Hallel should be said by the servants of God. Yet the miracle which took place in Persia, getting back to Purim, was done for who? The servants of Achashverosh. Because what happened to the Jews after the Purim story was over?
They became the subjects.
They went right back to living under Achashverosh's rule. So in a sense, it's like this big thing, we're drinking, we're celebrating, but guess what? Jewish history went right back to the way it was before. It's just that now we weren't being exterminated. But guess what? A week later, Achashverosh could have another prime minister who was an anti-Semite. And something else could happen a week later. Even after Mordechai had been appointed prime minister, he says, and walked about with royal clothes, he was a servant of Achashverosh. And he had to think every minute about Achashverosh's whims and moods. If Achashverosh wanted, he could have done to Mordechai what he did to Haman. According to this answer, it's not important whether we're in the land of Israel. What's really important is that what happened in Persia was with the grace and kindness and benevolence of this foolish and unstable man Achashverosh, whose whims were quite paradoxical and whose attitude could change any day. Many hundreds of thousands of Jews were saved, but Hallel was not warranted because the Jews in Persia still lacked a sense of security. If the Jews were not a sovereign people in Israel after the miracle of Hanukkah, Hallel would not have been warranted, as it would be a case of being servants of Antiochus instead of servants of God. Suppose Antiochus were not defeated, but he realized that the Jews are too strong and too stubborn to be overcome, and he issues an edict of tolerance, so that the Jews would be able to observe the Torah and mitzvah. In such a case, we would still have been servants of Antiochus, and at the very moment that Jewish sovereignty was restored, they instituted the Hallel. No one could be a prophet and know how long it would last, but the Jews enjoyed a sense of security. They had regained their sovereignty and political power. No one else could tell them what to do and what not to do. That is why Hallel fits into the framework of Hanukkah and not Purim. And I want to conclude with this, but I want to apply this to our own generation. Why does the Rambam have to say, after the temple was purified and everything was great, oh, and we had sovereignty restored for 200 years? We weren't being threatened anymore, because that's Purim. Purim was no more threats. But we were still insecure, because without independence, without sovereignty, and I would add, without the land of Israel, we don't really have any real security, and therefore the saying of Hallel is unwarranted. And today, when we have, this is the first time you realize, since 1948, this is the first time since the Hanukkah story, that we have political independence again in the land of Israel. We haven't had it since the Romans. Maimonides writes that because of the Maccabean revolt, the successful revolt against the Syrian Greek Seleucid Empire, we restored political sovereignty for 200 years until who came along and took it away from us and destroyed the temple and exiled our people? The Romans. And since that time, we haven't had sovereignty. And guess what we've had? We've had terrible persecution. We've had pogroms and crusades and inquisitions and persecutions and a Holocaust. And that is always possible without political sovereignty and without the land of Israel. And that's why on Hanukkah, one of the things we should think about is not only the great heroes of the Maccabees back then, without sounding too trite, we should be thinking about the IDF today and thinking about the sovereign political state of the land of Israel. Yes, it's secular. It's not observing Torah per se, but it's Jewish. And it's ours. And it allows us and affords us the opportunity to live the way we want. So even if we got saved, we still don't have to go back to the whims of some leader that could change their mind next week and another Purim catastrophe, God forbid, or please God, salvation can then happen. Now, there are no guarantees in life. And even Israel is surrounded by its enemies and we're nervous and we're fetching and we're upset about this. But it's still different. I want to end with a story that I've shared this before. If you heard it, it's worth bearing repetition. But we don't get perspective on this. I once went to solicit somebody here in the neighborhood for a donation for MJE, as I want to do. And I went to a elderly Holocaust survivor, happened to be a huge real estate mogul here on the west side. And I was sitting in his living room, waiting for him to come out. He was Kanai Nahara, 96 at the time, passed away at the age of 102. Henry Moskowitz, Zichrono Livracha. He was an amazing, amazing man. And I was sitting in his living room, and there was the New York Times, on the front page of the New York Times, there was this awful picture of this wrangled bust that had just been in this terrible suicide bombing. It was in the height of the Intifada, second Intifada. And I was reading it, waiting for him to come out, and by the time he came out, I just breathed some sort of sigh, and he said, in this heavy Europe, he says, he was from Poland, he says, "What's the matter?" You know, he saw it, so I said, I showed him the picture. And he said, "We never had it so good." I said, "Mr. Moskowitz, we never had it so good. But look at this picture. It's terrible." He says, "We never had it so good. Today we have a government. Today we have an army. We never had it so good." And he got me, I mean, I will never forget that experience. It was a perspective that we simply, those of us that were spared, the kinds of persecutions that our grandparents and great-grandparents, he lost a wife and a daughter in the Shoah and the Holocaust, came here with nothing, remarried, started a new family, became very successful, was a very erudite and committed Jew, an observant Jew, and he has perspective. And we have to understand that that's what happened in Hanukkah. We went from our sovereignty being taken away, becoming helpless, to becoming secure again. And Baruch Hashem, thank God, we are living in those times again. And so Hanukkah is really a time to celebrate the current Maccabees, as I say, and the situation in Israel today, which obviously has issues and has problems. But you can't even compare it when we thank God have a government and a state. And there are a lot of important parallels. I very much encourage you to read more of this on your own. There's amazing insights from Rabbi Soloveitchik about many things that have taken place over the last 2,000 years. Take this with you, read it, it's really worthwhile. I want to wish you all a happy Hanukkah and invite you all into the next room for a Hanukkah Chagiga. Please enjoy, and a Freilacha, happy Hanukkah to everyone.